Welcome to episode 17 of the Intersections on the Spectrum podcast. The Intersections on the Spectrum podcast is the brainchild of Doug Blitcher and Kelly Brown Johnson, created to discuss intersectional issues within the autistic community and give visibility to commonly marginalized, repressed, underrepresented, or erased identities and issues. We aim to introduce you to the people and stories you didn't know about but needed to hear, and hope that by seeing yourself represented in the community allows you to feel seen.
Today, we are very excited to be joined by Lyric Holmans, they-them, known online as the one and only Neurodivergent Rebel. The Neurodivergent Rebel opened their blog in 2016 as a way to introduce people unfamiliar with the concept of neurodiversity to this new way of seeing neurological difference. The blog, which is sometimes released in written format and sometimes as a YouTube video, explores the ideology of neurodiversity and the creative expressions of autistic people. Holmans' blog pushes for acceptance of neurological difference and respect for the autonomy of neurodivergent people. Lyric, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for that. I just realized how much that is to spit out. So thank you for spitting out quite all of that text with all of that in there.
I'm not good at speaking, but I do much better when I can read it. So
Well, thank you. I'm honored to be here. I'm excited just even seeing what your podcast is about. It's like, ooh, I love it. I love it. I can't wait to have a conversation today.
Thank you. To start our conversation, what would you say are the identities that you would say that describe you?
Oh, goodness. Many, many identities. I have known for, a long time I was a queer person, because that's something that generally, when you're, I knew young that I wasn't attracted to people of any one particular gender. And so you know that you're different from that perspective very clearly, because society's like, this is queer, this is not queer. So, I knew that identity for a large part of my life. But I say I'm a late discovered neurodivergent person, which multiply neurodivergent, autistic, and ADHD. And I think that late discovered piece is really important, because not knowing that your brain is different, or the ways your brain is different, you still know you're different, and it has these impacts on your life when you don't know this information about yourself. It's a bit different than if those that find out earlier in life. And then, the other identities that come with that is, after figuring out I was neurodivergent and realizing, okay, well, I don't care. I'm done trying to live up to all of society's expectations and standards. And I started realizing how many things I was doing was performative. Is like that trans piece of me came out, and I was like, okay, well, now I've got to deal with this issue that I'm non-binary, and all of these other feelings that I've been repressing. It's like once one mask cracks and you realize I'm performing neurotypical. Oh, I'm performing female gender. I'm performing what I think society wants of me, and none of it was for my own sake. And so, there's a lot of identities there. I'm also, I'm mixed race, but I'm white passing, I'm white native. So, there's things that people don't know about me, and most of my identities are all invisible. And that's the thing, is a lot of those experiences, from being queer to autistic, or anything else, it's all, I see how similar. This is the same, you know. And so it's I get excited when we get to talk about how those things intersect. So, oh boy, we get to geek out today.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot that we could talk about. And we managed to get it down to nine small questions. But for sure, I follow you on Facebook and I see your post, and I'm just always like. There's always something. So, yeah.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
That support means a lot.
So you do a lot of work, advocacy work for our community, and you've gotten a lot of heat recently for lobbying against ABA. So I'd like you to share a bit more about what you accomplished and what that experience was like.
Well, the Texas legislature, it's hard. It sometimes feels like you aren't accomplishing a lot. It wasn't my bill, but I was asked to come testify in support of a bill here in Texas, and I'm bad with numbers, so the numbers are transposed in my head wrong, so I'm not going to try to get the House bill named. but it was basically just asking for a study on the efficacy and the outcomes of ABA and the costs and all of this, and all of these claims that have been made, because recently in Texas, you know, it was passed so that more children were going to have access to ABA through public funding. It was like, okay, well, of all these public funding's going to go to ABA, let's like really do a study on all the funding, all the outcomes of these kids, things like that, before we put that into place and like really look at it. They did start with a hashtag that was like, stop ABA in Texas. But it wasn't really going to stop ABA. It was just asking us to take a closer look at ABA. And the scaremongering around that bill, like once I got involved, which it was horrible, because it was like, oh, look, they're trying to take away all these services from your children. They're going to make sure your children can't get any kind of therapy. You know, and it was like they were saying all these things that we weren't even doing if people even would have looked at the bill. What's hard about that is it's like, no, we want children to have access to therapy if they need them, but appropriate therapies. Like, I already know, because I've been talking to a lot of people internationally in other countries where ABA comes in other states, it tends to leech all the funding and services away from other more proven, less controversial, and more like safe things that can be helpful, such as occupational therapy, or, you know, things that help around communication, speech and language therapy, depending on if ABA has creeped into that or not, because even that happened. But there are other things that are safer that are already existing that, you know, once ABA comes in and takes over, are often no longer available too. So it's like we want to advocate for those services so that this doesn't come in and take over and become the only thing. Because so many autistic people know that this is traumatizing. And we've got victims speaking up saying that they've been traumatized. And I, you know, I'm a formal animal behaviorist, and I know a lot of these methods that they're still using on autistic and neurodivergent kids today in ABA have been thought of as like, you don't do that to a dog, you don't do that to an animal, that is too cruel to use on animals for years. But why is this okay with children, human disabled children? This is not okay. It's treat them like they're pets, worse than pets. You know, I don't even treat my animals like pets. Like, they're a lot more autonomous. If you give them the chance, my dogs know a lot of language, can communicate their needs to me and things like that. Like, I don't try to train them. I just try to build a relationship and then teach them how to communicate with me when they need something. And I give them choices. Do you want this or that? You know, and they can make choices if I empower them to do that. But it's a different kind of a mindset with empowering and equipping instead of control and coercion and trying to, you know, kids are seen, not heard kind of a mindset is almost where that ABA feels come down from.
Yeah, I think for me the biggest issue is that the goals are not the child's goals. They're mm-hmm. the goals of what the parents want to see their kids doing. And it's like, that's mm-hmm. creepy.
And that's like bad dog training. It's the same thing. Like, they want a quiet, compliant, obedient dog
that's
just going to do whatever you say. And that's what's scary too about ABA is it's not just being peddled for autistic kids anymore. I've seen it peddled as like this behavior therapy that's for like any kid that has bad behavior. We'll send your kid away to this camp and you'll get a new kid when you come back. Like, wow, what was wrong with the first kid you had? Like, wow, you know, like, and even like the marketing on these things, like the, like that's worded. It's like, do you understand? Like, the kid's like, oh, my mom doesn't want me. My mom wants a new kid. Like, how does that feel if you're the child and you see that like brochure on your parents' table that they bought this brochure, it promises to give them a new kid and they're going to send your kid, you know?
Yeah. But I can say, you know, even if you don't notice some of the impacts, I know that changes are happening. I've seen it because my youngest son possibly has fetal alcohol syndrome. We don't know yet. So I'm part of a lot of fetal alcohol groups. And sometimes it's suggested that they get some sort of therapy where, you know, they say, oh, we're recommending ABA for FAS. And there's actually already studies that prove that ABA does not work for kids with FAS, first of all.
Oh, good.
So we have those studies. And when I look at the comments in, you know, when in these groups, when people are saying, should I send my kid for this? You know, they send the links, they send the link to the study, and they go, you know, they say, also, they go, the autistic community has been saying it's harmful and doesn't even work for autism. So why would we use it on our kids?
Mm-hmm.
So the word is getting out. Like, people are understanding, people are reading, people are learning more and starting to you know, parent in such ways that they're mm-hmm. not going to resort to these kind of methods. And so it is, change is happening. Even in the last like 10 years that I've been involved in advocacy, I've seen changes. So
I think it's encouraging. I mean, with the House, it's like the bill got all the way through the House unopposed, you know, and then it made it to the Senate, and then it just ran out of time and calendars and didn't get on to the floor. So we didn't get heard in the Senate, you know, but, well, you know, it had a good shot. And, you know, maybe next year. Our legislative sessions are limited. So maybe next session. I don't know when the next session starts. But there was a lot of support. Like, we didn't have any opposition, really. So, I mean, that's a good sign.
Mm-hmm. And it makes sense anyway. If you're going to implement something like that, it has to be cost effective for everybody. It doesn't even make sense that you would spend money on an intervention that doesn't actually give you results that you want. So
yeah. Well, what they promise is it's like, if they do this, then the autistic kids are going to be able to go to mainstream school and not be in special education. They have all these promises that ABA is going to do all these things, which it's like, okay, based on what evidence, you know?
And why is that what's desired?
Like, yeah.
Is that what's best, well, or just because?
Yeah, or is that because the state gets money for the kids being in? But yeah, I don't know. Like, why? Yeah, why? I don't know. We'll see.
So Lyric, you know, for many of us in the autistic community and also outside it, I'm sure, are shocked by the Judge Rottenberg Center allowing to shock autistic people and those with intellectual disabilities. So I guess my understanding was that the FDA is unable to ban the procedure, so that's why the court upheld its use. We know you're not a lawyer, but do you have any ideas now that the community can use going forward to try to ban this practice?
I have a hard time believing the FDA can't ban this. You know, like, they can ban things. Like, I think if they had enough pressure from the public and enough outrage, they would have to ban this, you know? And so that's why there's been a lot of outcry on social media and rallying to get people to start talking about this. But it seems like the algorithms don't let this take off, which is really frustrating. Or because I have to assume, I have to think that's what it is, because it hurts too much to think nobody cares about autistic and disabled kids. Like, that is the alternative. It's either social media is burying these hashtags and nobody cares, which that breaks my heart. Like, that can't be it. We really need people who have larger social media reaches than any autistic advocate that I personally know. A lot of us, I've got a fairly large reach, but I don't have anywhere near reach as like any of the top, you know, real celebrities in America or any country have. Like, if we had 5 celebrities with million reach or more helping us support this cause, amplifying us, even one would probably be helpful. But everyone's thinking about other things. Everyone's distracted. Nobody's giving this any attention. And that's what really bothers me, is we need people to, like, get attention on this. Because I feel like if more people actually knew and really understood what was happening, saw the videos, heard the victims, heard the survivors of this speaking, I think people would be outraged. But where is the media coverage? Where is the coverage? Where is the noise? It's just buried in everything else. Nobody's talking about it, except us,
yeah.
Autistic people. Yeah. We're screaming into the void of the internet, and there's just nothing, no response.
Yeah, you know, like you said, the alternative is that it is sad. I mean, in the sense that you know, disabled lives in general are not valued. When I try to explain that people are getting shocked, they kind of think, oh, well, the person's misbehaving or something. I'm like, no, actually, they're just getting shocked because they fidgeted in their seat, or they didn't, you know, write something quickly enough, like, or they peed themselves. Like, it's just, like, really arbitrary things. And I don't think people have a concept. And I think the other issue as well is that we tend to silo issues and make it individual. And when you do that, you can just go like, oh, it's just this place over here. And that's kind of what's happening. Oh, it's just this place over here. It's just at the Judge Rottenberg Center. So we can forget about it and think about it. It's an isolated thing. And it's like, well, no, actually, it's systemic. This is how people are treated, not just in the U.S., but like all over the world. In places that you don't know about, and things that are happening that you don't know about.
And it's not always shock collars. Sometimes it's exclusion. Sometimes it's restraint. Sometimes it's just being treated like you are less than human. You know, my partner worked in one of these facilities that was in charge of caring for people when he was younger, before him and I met, before he knew he was neurodivergent. But know, he was the one that was always getting in trouble because he treated them like people. So, you know, that wasn't what was expected. And this isn't an isolated incident. This is like the norm in so many of these facilities where people who have disabilities or people who are neurodivergent, we're just treated like we are subhuman and we're treated like we are the problem. And it's like, oh, these people are violent. These people are acting out. These people are lashing out. They would give him those people that they thought were going to give him trouble as his, like, and hinder his care, even though he was not qualified, but they were trying to, like, haze him into leaving. And they wouldn't act out with him because he didn't treat them like less than human. He didn't treat them poorly. He treated them like equals, and it was totally different. He didn't need to tackle anybody. He didn't need to put anybody on the ground like they would, you know, say to put him on the ground and all that. It's like, no, you don't need to do that to people. But it's when you have this mindset of coercion, control, obey, comply, it doesn't work with animals or people.
Mm-hmm. It's so sad. It's so sad. Okay, on to the next intersection.
Yes, so much. That's an important one, though, because we need to talk about it, because we really need to keep up that conversation so people don't forget about it, because it is still ongoing, even if people aren't talking about it. So.
Yeah, and that's, yeah.
And it's a horrible thing to talk about. It sucks, you know.
Well, keep the heat on. We're going to keep the heat on then that one. So also recently on your Instagram, you mentioned how the gender binary hurts everyone. In what ways do you see it being most harmful?
Well, you know, there are, like, for example, like, non-binary people, it's the most obvious. It's like, oh, you don't exist. You have to be X or, you know, X or Y. You have to fit in this box or this box. You have to fit in this checkbox. And anything in the middle is obscure. You know, that erases us completely. So that hurts. It is racially a problem because it is something that's been brought in as, like, a colonial mindset. And so, you know, we have cultures all over the world before colonialism came in and erased them that had other genders, and the gender wasn't binary. So, like, strict binary roles are, like, enforced, you know, as part of white Christian culture, which is oppressive. And, you know, I'm a queer person, so I'm like, I grew up in the Bible Belt in Texas, where the church wasn't very nice about people like me. So it's horrible to have, like, you know, men must do this, women must do this. And, you know, it made me feel very lost and confused growing up, even before I realized I was non-binary, because, you know, I knew trans people growing up, but I didn't know trans non-binary people. I only knew trans men or trans women. So, like, I had this very binary view of gender. You know, when you don't fit into that, it's like, okay, but where do I fit? You know? And so that really is hard. But then it also is hard on women who, you know, maybe they aren't non-binary, but maybe they're just women and they feel like they don't conform to, like, oh, women are supposed to do, you know, check, check, check. And then if they don't do those things, are they less of a woman? Or if we say we define women only by their body parts and we say women are, you know, certain body parts. And then, you know, a woman loses those body parts. Are they now no longer a woman? You know, like, it's how we are defining womanhood or manhood the same way. It's like, are men only defined by these body parts? What if they lose that body part? I mean, I know a man who would lose that body part because society says now you're not a man. You're going to feel emasculated because society put all of that value in your masculinity on that one body part. You know, so it hurts even the cis straight people. It hurts trans binary people. Because now, you know, if you're a trans woman, you're like, I must conform to this binary stereotype. You know, if you feel like you're being pushed into this binary. So it hurts everybody. You know, it's like toxic masculinity. All of these things, like, come into this, like, gender binary that if we just let that go and stop saying, like, you know, we've got to be this way and just let gender be fluid, I personally believe everyone would be a lot better off.
Yeah, I kind of identify very much with some sort of, like, you know, some people say Ashi gender. I think the best term that fits for me is probably androgen. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I didn't have those terms when I was growing up. So I thought I was bisexual because that was the closest approximation.
Mm-hmm.
Because I only had, it was like, you were gay, you were bi, or you were lesbian. That was all that kind of existed in my time. So I'm like, well, I must be bisexual because I feel like I'm a mix of male and female. So it was really confusing because then I wasn't necessarily you know, I'll say I'm queer kind of thing more so than anything else at this point. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like giving people the language, giving people the understanding, having people just kind of break out of this box, these, you know, these very rigid boxes of how people should be. Or, you know, for me, I've always been extremely ambivalent to my body parts. So I call myself gender agnostic almost, because it's just like, you call me sir or you call me miss, I don't care. I honestly don't care. The only title I do not like is Mrs. So don't ever call me Mrs. But otherwise, I don't, you know, it doesn't matter to me. So, it doesn't mean anything to me almost. But I don't want to say that in a way that like it invalidates other people's genders.
No, I get it.
It's just for me, I just really don't
feel
either way at all.
And I can totally respect that. See, with me, it's like, I'm like, really, at this point, anything but she. And that's only because that's what people are going to misinterpret me as the most. And, like, for me, I feel like that's a lie. Mm-hmm. And I like to be honest and authentic. And it's like, I feel like you say she, and I'm like, not really. And it's like, I'm either going to not correct it and feel like I am a lie, or I'm going to deal with the discomfort of correcting you. And it's like, do you really want to do this with a grocery checker you're going to see for 2 minutes? Do you want to do this every single human you meet? You know, every stranger in the street? Is it worth explaining? Because I'm in Texas, realize most of these people are like, they is not one person. it's like, what's a ZZM? Like, they're not going to get it.
Yeah.
Around here. So it's like, it's exhausting. I hope I can confuse people enough they might ask, but usually it's just going to be she. And I'm just like, okay, well, yeah, you're wrong, but okay. I'm trying to like reframe it in my mind, like, okay, well, you're wrong, but that's not my problem.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Because it's like, otherwise, it's like, especially where I'm living, even if I have my they, them pin, it doesn't. Almost like last time I wore it out somewhere, I got like the most loud, obnoxious, and like intentionally direct ma'am at the end of an appointment where somebody had been obviously looking at it for like an hour. So they knew it. And it was like, oh, okay, now I know why you were being a jerk to me the whole appointment. It didn't even occur to me. It was like, Texas, this is still Texas. Okay.
You know, we're put into essentially two piles when we're born, males or females. And so I've thrown in the male pile. And you were talking about toxic masculinity before. Being in the male pile, males will definitely, like, for some reason want to share these viewpoints with me. And then when I question them, it's like, There's a really long, awkward pause, and a lot of times the responses are quite interesting. But I'm just wondering, like, from your perspective, how do you see, like, how do you feel like that could change if we start to develop actually more than two piles in the human experience?
I think it could be very healing to set down some of those expectations. And I see there's a push for this. You know, already we're seeing more about like allowing men to express their feelings, which was thought of as totally taboo for long. Like the toxic masculinity says men have to be tough all the time and men can't have feelings. And it's like most people who love men say, I would like for my man to share their feelings with me. You know, they don't want their man to be repressed and hiding all of their feelings, because that really harms your relationship anyway. So it's like it trickles down to everyone you touch. You're hiding your feelings and nobody gets to know the real you. All of these problems come from that. So it's like, you know, that's one thing that I think could be really good. And even like with the pressure on women, like you watch TV shows, like women tend to like be portrayed in shows as like very competitive with each other, very catty with each other. Like it's just nasty behavior a lot of times, in competition with each other. Where it's like, we need to let some of that go too. So it's like, we don't talk about that as much, how some of that is really toxic as well. And, you know, all we do talk about now about how they used to have the mindsets, like, you know, women need to be rescued. That's become like taboo finally, thank goodness, that we're not like, if you're a woman, you don't need to be rescued. You don't need a man to complete you, because that was like the narrative for many years. So the narratives are evolving and changing. And I think society is improving as this happens. There's a lot of repairs that need to be done, you know, on all sides of it. And, you know, it's like a lot of people right now are so scared of non-binary people because they don't understand. People are afraid when they don't understand. And, like, I see a lot of the most shade comes from women that are seem to be upset. They're like, why are you casting away your femininity? Like, they're, like, so upset, like, by it. It's like, you don't understand. Like, it's okay. Like, we will all be better together if we learn from each other. You know, it's not like a competition to like trying to destroy masculinity or femininity or any of that. It's just saying that those things can live in everybody and can be fluid and situational and, you know, changing and evolving. And, you know, we need to think about these things in less fixed ways.
Now, one of your identities is being polyamorous.
Oh, yeah.
How do you see the intersection of that between your autistic identity?
Well, you know, I never, like, I remember being a young person and realizing very early on that I had that propensity to have deep affections for more than one person at the same time. And that was taboo and thought of as being a player or whatever. You know, that was not okay. But it's also funny because I've also, since learning I was neurodivergent, realized that when I have a passion or a hobby, I fall in love with that passion, that hobby too, very much the same way that I fall in love with a person. And, you know, it's no different. Like, you know, it's like I've got to divide that energy up equally regardless. But, you know, being neurodivergent, I think for me means I feel like this is something that I don't need to hide as much as where, because social constructs, my part of my autistic experience, although this is not every autistic person, like I know some very rule following autistic people, but like I tend to be like, see the social construct and go, no thanks, or I don't get it. No. And so like with being monogamous, I'm just like, oh, I don't get it. No. Like I'm like geeking out over like the history of how it was used to put women as property and all these things. So I'm like, ew, no, it's like terrible, you know, and like diamonds, the diamond industry. So like I dive too deeply into like all of those traditions of monogamy and go, oh, this is not, I can't even pretend to like it, you know, where it was like the norm for everyone around me. And like a lot of people around me wouldn't even question it. And then the fact that I was questioning this, you know, even at a young age, people are just like, what's wrong with you? Why would you question this? Like, this is the institution upon, you know, which everything else is built. And it's funny because it's just like another social construct that I'm like, I don't understand, like, monogamy. It doesn't make sense to me. But some people can be monogamous and that just makes sense to them, right? So it was like just another normal thing to me. Like, well, why does everyone have to do this? Just because it seemed compulsory. You know, it's like, I don't go around with things that just seem compulsory. I have to understand the why behind anything before I do it. Like, if you're telling me how to do a task at work, you can't tell me just to do the task. I need to understand why I'm doing the task and appreciate the why and do it. I can't just, like, fake it, get my way through. I have to know something pretty intimately. So it's like not just like realizing when I was young that I had this propensity to have deep affections at different levels for multiple people. It's not like necessarily a sexual thing either. But then the fact that I wouldn't question it, or, you know, the fact that I knew I had the propensity to love people of any gender, and like that was thought of as being exhibitionist back then. It was like, no, I just don't feel I need to hide it. I didn't fear the embarrassment.
I think autistic people in general are pretty immune to some extent to peer pressure a lot of the time, right?
Sometimes.
They don't want to, follow those trends necessarily.
It depends on the thing, though, I think. Because there have been situations where I know I'd like to say that, but I've fallen into peer pressure before sometimes, depending on what it was, you know?
I don't know. I'm pretty non-conformant to some
extent.
I think people might have an idea or a misconception, though, that the autistic people would not want to have multiple relationships because, you know, apparently we're not supposed to like people, we're not supposed to have feelings, we're not supposed to want sex, we're not, you know, we're disabled, like, sexless beings, right? We don't have relationships, or we have a lot of trouble having relationships, so how could we possibly have more than one? But for me, like, I don't like the term polyamory. There's too many things hung up in that. So we use open relationship, but, or at least ethical non-monogamy or something like
that. Yeah.
But I don't like polyamory. I don't like the word. I don't like the associations with it. For me, it was really about more like not wanting to be a possession.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
Like,
yes.
Ownership. That's, you know, have freedom and stuff, and not freedom in a reckless way, like you said. It's
like
it's,
I don't
just
own
the
my partner. Yeah,
right.
Exactly. And I don't want to be owned. And yeah, that is so spot on.
Yeah. So that was very strongly in me from my very first relationship. So people are always kind of surprised because I've never actually been monogamous. Like, from my, like, first high school relationships, it was always like, no, you don't own me. This is how it's going to be. If you want to be with me,
yeah,
you have to deal with it. And that was pretty much it. It was just like non-negotiable. Sorry. This is how I am. This is how it's going to be. But yeah, not that I had tons of, you know, open relationships in high school,
but that doesn't always go over well, does it?
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. No.
I'm glad people are talking about this more now, though, because I think years ago it was like you would say that, and the only thing people would say is, "Oh, you're a slut."
Yeah,
that's all people would say. It was like, "No, I'm not a slut." Like a lot of times, it wasn't even about sex, you know.
Well, that's it. Yeah, it's an interesting concept to try and convey when you're 16, 17 years old. But I had no words. I had no words.
And the adults are like, no.
There was no vocabulary for that. There was nothing until I turned 19 and somebody told me the word. And I didn't. I was just like, I just want this. Or I want our relationship to be like this. I don't know what it is, but this is what I want. And that was, yeah, no terminology for me back then.
Oh, yeah, I know. No, there really wasn't. And there was no, and there's no role model. There's no example of it. No. Even now, we don't have a lot of examples of this in, like, good examples of this in pop culture or in media. But they're
even the documentaries, like, bad. There were some bad documentaries. I cringed, and, yeah, anyways.
Everything's cringe. It's all cringe. But, I mean, I guess it's the beginning. Like, people are just starting to share more, so hopefully it'll get better.
We'll see.
I have skepticism right now.
It's an interesting discussion because I, you know, I'm married. I have one partner, but I've always felt kind of icky by saying my wife, my partner. That type of language really has made me always feel uncomfortable.
But I mean, you could still have more than one wife, and that would still be your wife, right? Like they're all your wife.
It's connotating possession, isn't it? Though.
Yeah. Well, I still say my husband, even though he's my husband. Just like my kids are my kids, I don't own them though. It's just the dynamic that we have built around that is what's important, not so much that, like. I mean, at the same time, my husband could also be someone else's partner, and that's okay too. Right? It's not implicit in that kind of thing, so.
I wonder how much of that comes from our neurodivergent desire for autonomy and, like, knowing the cost of having your autonomy taken away, because I think so many of us, like, have that happen to us. Whether intentionally or not, like, it's a parent speaking over us or speaking for us or, you know, in some other system. It's like, I would never want to take the autonomy away from another person. And like I don't even like being in control of my dogs. I think of myself as their custodians. I'm their waiter. You know, I clean up their messes and I bring them food and I serve them.
But yeah, for me, like, it's also just about choice, right? Like, I don't want someone to be with me because they think that they have to be, or that, you know, I've captured them and conquered them and they're mine now. I want everybody to decide every day to make a choice to be with me. Mm-hmm. To me, that's what love is. You know, wake up in the morning and say, I want to be with you, and not, I have to be with you.
Yes.
You know? So,
yes.
Like,
so much.
Any minute, you know, my husband can walk out the door and not come back. And I have to be okay with that. Mm-hmm. And I can do the same thing, too, and he has to be okay with that. But there's a trust there where you're like, okay, well, it's probably not going to happen. And I have nothing to live in fear. I'm going to love him when he's here. And that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think some people can't grasp it, but it's like, I can't grasp, like, going, like, ever pretending to be a different way, you know, or, you know, putting that piece of myself kind of back in the closet, because it was always like, oh, this is how I am, this is our relationship, but it wasn't, like, it wasn't anything that we shared very much, unless people really dug and asked, and it was, like, kind of more like, oh, this is kind of a secret, because, like, I don't know. Like, when I had a corporate job and things, you, like, worry. Like, you have these code of ethics and things. Like, if that was out on social media when I had that previous job, I could have been, like, go for that.
Yeah,
know?
For sure. Yeah.
Because it's, like, so taboo. And, like, now I don't have a boss. I can say whatever I want. Now I'm like, oh, my gosh, I can't imagine, like, going back to that world where you and I can't openly have this discussion. Because if you would have asked me this question back when I was in that corporate job, I would have been in a panic. I would have been like, we can't do this question. We can't talk about this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I would have had to hide a piece of myself.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Let's go, if you don't mind, Lyric. We'll talk a bit about your living situation. So
yeah,
you've been living in an RV for 3 years. So what went into that whole decision? And can I make it a two-pronged question? We'll say, what are the benefits?
Yeah. So I guess the what led into the decision is the benefits. We had been talking about getting an RV, maybe a small RV, and doing some traveling for a long time. We're like, oh, in 10 years, maybe once we'll be able to afford to do this thing. And, you know, we had this house and this mortgage, and, you know, we're here in Texas, so we're near Austin, where real estate is just going and going and going. And we had it for almost 5 years, and the property taxes just kept going up to the roof. And it was just like so intense, and things kept breaking because we buy a house and it's a money pit. It is a money pit, you know, and it was just like, it was so overwhelming to have this house to keep up with in my head, like thinking, I'm going to pay this mortgage for 30 years of my life. Like, I have anxiety already, and anxiety of having extra pressure hot hold sitting over my head like that. Like, what if I lose my job? Like, my seizures were coming back really bad because stress, corporate job, you know, all of this, of course. And so I was like really scared. What if I'm not going to be able to work? What's going to happen? Like, so there was so much worry about the house. We decided that financially it didn't make sense anymore to try and hold on to this house. And, you know, looking back, I'm so glad, you know, we sold the house because it was a hard decision. But, you know, the RV, like, because the market was good, we were able to put a good payment on the RV into the house so that we didn't have to get a big loan or anything like that. We're living much lower expenses in the RV, so that's one of the big benefits, is we did it just to spend less, to escape the really ridiculous housing market here in Central Texas. We are living smaller, so as a neurodivergent human, it is so awesome to have less to keep track of, less to clean. Like, even if that house is very messy, it's a little tube. It's a rectangle tube. I just go back to front. It's really easy for me to just like work my way across it within a short period of time. When I have the house, it's like, cannot keep up with it. It's like one part's clean. It's never all clean. It was just like so much stress that, you know, we didn't really need. But we did get a larger RV because we have four dogs. And so we have four dogs and a large RV. So that was like a big thing. We had to have enough space for them because they're family. You know, we didn't want them to not have space to kind of get away from each other when they need to or whatever, because they had a backyard that they were losing. But, you know, we'd go out and hike and walk, and we probably could have gone smaller. But now, you know, we're in our roaming sensory bubble. So it's like traveling before, like you get on a plane or whatever and you go somewhere and you get a hotel. Like, all of that's really expensive. It costs a lot more to travel. And like, as an autistic person, new places, new situations, not knowing what I'm going to be, you know, what I'm getting myself into is really stressful for me. So it takes away from a lot of my experience traveling. Whereas like, I have my house with me when we travel in the RV. And so I get sensory overload. I get overwhelmed. I can't handle anymore. I can go crash and hide in my bed, my bed, you know, and it's safe and secure. And I have those comforts with me. I have my own bathroom because public bathrooms are terrible, especially as like a non-binary person. There is no bathroom for me. But anyway, they're just gross and dirty on top of that. So I don't have to go to a gross, dirty, public, binary bathroom. I have my own. So like, there's a lot of good things about it. And I can't imagine going back to living in a house. I'm playing devil's advocate really hard against my partner. Let's go smaller. Which, you know, he's not totally on board with that yet. I'll keep working on it.
And Lyric, if any of our listeners weren't aware of you before this podcast, how can they connect with you after they're done listening to you?
I'm actually really easy to find, so that's the good news. If you go to neurodivergentrebel.com, or if you Google Neurodivergent Rebel, I'm everywhere. I'm on every social media platform. The only thing that's a bit of an anomaly is Twitter, is at NeuroRebel, because Neurodivergent Rebel was too many characters, which, I mean, it's a mouthful, so that makes sense. But yeah, I'm easy to find.
All right, so what kinds of stories do you think we should highlight as we go forward with more episodes of the Intersections on the Spectrum podcast? What would you like to see?
What I really want more of, that we don't have enough of out there in the community, is hearing from non-speaking autistic people. That is what we need to be amplifying, especially, you know, we talked about the JRC today, but a lot of autistic people that are going to be impacted by some of these issues, or more impacted, are going to be those who are non-speaking, or also those who have additional intellectual disability. Like, we need to hear those voices and we need to hear those stories. You know, and of course, you're already focusing autistic people who are multiply marginalized in general. So, you know, that of course continues to be important, you know, right now and moving forward as always.
think from my experience, when you actually do listen, when people do listen to non-speaking autistics, they are loud. They are loud.
Yes,
you know, when,
they have the best things to say. They have the best perspectives.
Absolutely amazing. And yeah, just very well, I don't want to say well-spoken, but they express themselves really well and really clearly and say things that I was like, damn, like just really like hit it. You know, they really hit the nail on the head kind of thing. And so people do really need to listen to them because we are saying the same things. And that's what's also cool when people think, well, no, non-speaking people have to have different needs. No, we're actually really, like, I'd say, like 95% in agreement with everything. They're just saying it better. They're saying it louder.
Way better.
You know?
And it's just like, we need, like, sometimes people don't understand, like, oh, how do I get a non-speaker on a Zoom or a podcast? It's like, we do it. It's like, you have someone that reads for them or, you know, like, the different ways you can do it. They might have a device that they can, you know, it'll read, if they have a device that reads for them too. So it's like, but it can be done. And I think it's so important. And every single time a non-speaker shares their perspective, I learn something new. So it's like those people are who I want to learn from, the people who really have the experience. And honestly, it frustrates me because I see society is like, doesn't get to hear from this group. Autistic people who have the most to say.
They're or they don't want to listen.
It. Or that, yes, I hate that. It's like, this group has a lot to say, and we just need to meet them and listen to them and hear. We need to be willing to hear them.
Mm-hmm. We've had one.
Yes.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah,
one that used AAC, yeah.
Yeah.
We need more.
We need more. Yes, we need more.
We will. We'll be working on it, for sure.
Yeah. That's great.
Well, Lyric, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with me and Kelly about some really important things.
Thank you for inviting me and letting me ramble and info dump and word vomit.
Yay!
So much fun.